forms of Western storytelling is the so-called Bildungsroman, a German term for which the English equivalent is coming-of-age novel. Though often thought to have begun in the late 18th century with Goethe's Wilhelmmeister's apprenticeship, it came into prominence in the 19th century. Here we must think of British works like Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, 1861, American works like Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, 1884, or perhaps Russian works like Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Adolescent, also known as The Roy Youth, 1875. Though, like all literary terms, there's no agreement on precisely what the coming-of-age novel is, the following ideas about it have generally been proffered, some of which are commonsensical given the term itself. Put most simply, such stories focus on the psychological and moral growth of a character from youth to adulthood, early adulthood, really. But the paradigm has been seen to be more complex than that. Most often, it assumes that the protagonist will change from the beginning of the story until the end, and frequently that change involves attaining a degree of what society deems maturity. In its most traditional iteration, the narrative will also involve a conflict between the protagonist and society, and typically he or she will move closer toward accepting mainstream values. There are other features that characterize some coming-of-age tales. One, often the story begins with some kind of loss. Two, sometimes the protagonist is orphaned or parentless, if not literally, then metaphorically. Three, frequently the protagonist has lost faith in society's values. Four, usually the conflict that the protagonist experiences in part exists within the protagonist, him or herself. And five, often the story ends ambiguously, without a clear narrative closure. Finally, we might note that like all traditional forms of literature, the paradigmatic character who came of age was male. Though there have been exceptions like Jane Austen's Emma, 1815, or in more recent era, something like, not really recent, Betty Smith's 1943, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I've gone into some detail about the Bildungsroman because Valerie Guy Germanica's 2008 film, Everybody Dies But Me, can be placed in that literary and also cinematic genre. If you think today, films like Boyhood or Moonlight, you know, again, male stories. We have a kind of example of coming-of-age films with very, very different contexts and individuals. But first, a word about the 33-year-old director herself. She was born to, and this, you know, I get both from what the program notes you have, also from the web. She was born to a Bohemian Moscow family, trained at the Internews Cinema and Television School. She began directing when she was 19, and her 2005 documentary films, The Girls and The Birthday of the Infanta, appeared at the Kino Bar Film Festival. In 2010, Channel One aired her 69-episode TV series, School, which again, we can see sort of focuses on youth, portraying teenage life in Moscow school. Since then, she's also been the creative director for MTV Russia. So her work focuses very much on youth, and the fact that this is a coming-of-age film should be no surprise. Given all this, it is no surprise that Everybody Dies But Me is a coming-of-age film. Though it concerns adolescence, it is decidedly not a teen flick, as we would call it in the United States. A term that has come to be associated with lighthearted movies that are meant for a youthful audience, often semi-comic, often involving romance, you know. As the program, more intelligent ones would be, or even the one that was based on Emma, I'm forgetting the name of that.
Clueless?
Yeah, Clueless would be one of them. Oh, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That's, you know, one of the more intelligent ones. It comes to me eventually. I've had enough coffee there. As the program notes indicate, however, Everybody Dies With Me is not, that is, a teen flick. though of course some young people might find it precisely what they are after. Here there might be parallels with J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, which when published in 1951 was aimed at grown-ups but gained popularity with adolescents. The film is also like the Salinger novel, though about an entirely different culture and population. It is focused on rebellious youth who struggle with societal norms, a sine qua non of the coming of age paradigm. The film conforms to the model in other ways. It begins with a loss in the form of a burial of a cat and the murder of several goldfish. It's probably the only film in film history in which goldfish are murdered. And death is not only in the title, but in much of the opening dialogue. One girl, for instance, says it would be cruel if all adults died. And another, speaking of older students in their school, remarks, we'll die later than the others. Second, several of the girls whose lives we follow are at least metaphorically parentless, as there is violence and a lack of communication within their families, and home represents the place from which they wish to escape. Finally, the film ends ambiguously with one teenager crying in her room, no solution to her or society's problems in sight. But many aspects of the film do not follow the conventional path. First of all, we have three protagonists, Katya, Zana, and Vita, all of them through a difficult period between childhood and adulthood. This liminal stage is illustrated best in a scene in which, after talking about where they might be able to buy cocktails, they go into a candy store and buy lollipops, and then taste each other's lollipops and decide which flavors they like. At times, and especially at the beginning of the film, which is lacking any conventional exposition, we don't know which girl we're following, and sometimes get them confused. Furthermore, unlike the proper coming-of-age protagonist, but similar perhaps to Holden Caulfield, none of the young women achieves what their culture would deem maturity or adopts its values. Rather, by the film's end, all have experienced some trauma, be it rape, battery, attempted suicide, alcohol poisoning, or careless promiscuity. Hence, it's a very dark work that offers no saccharine vision of adolescence as a mere stage to be transcended. Rather, it portrays young people who seem terminally alienated from the society and families in which they've been raised. Neither does the film allow us very easily to identify with its heroines. While one father is violent with his daughter, he also appears in other scenes to love her. On the other hand, the girl in question is cruel, both to her parents as well as to a classmate whom she uses for nefarious purposes, then abandons. Furthermore, she routinely lies to everyone and ultimately has sex with a young man whom she knows one of her best friends adores. This despite an earlier pact the girls made to never compete for boyfriends. Given that the drama's about adolescence, sex plays a major role in the story. In the beginning, only as a subject of gossip between the young women, but later as a real life event. While their conversations are all about boys, there is also a homoerotic sense to the three girls' attachment to one another. In one scene, two of them have a sleepover date and retire into the same bed, and we almost expect them to make love. We wonder if it is only societal pressure that restrains them from considering that object choice. Significantly, it is the school's promise of a disco night that provides opportunity for sexual and romantic liaisons and sets aspects of the drama into motion. Such an event is held out by the school as a reward for what appears to be a rote, regimented, and unimaginative education. As in many coming-of-age works, The Catcher in the Rye included, school stands in for the larger society. While none of the teachers are portrayed as terrible, they all seem old and out of touch with the youngsters, underlying the shift in outlook from one generation to another. And this is certainly a film about generational distance in lots of ways. Significantly, a literature teacher is dismayed when students do not recognize a work from which she quotes, a familiar experience for many of us, I might add. And she is nonplussed when they complain about studying in Mandelstam, since it is not required reading for their grade, not part of the plan, assuming that that's what that means. As a microcosm of broader culture, student relations in the school are reminiscent of Lord of the Flies, a state of war in which the older bully the younger, both verbally and in one sequence, a fight over a boy with brutal corporeality. In another scene, a girl steals a younger classmate's ring and viciously tosses it out of his bathroom window. Furthermore, while the film focuses on the female school population, the males that we see are predatory and dismissive of women. After raping a girl, one boy calls her an idiot and commands her to roll over. While in coming of age, one is supposed to move into adulthood, the grown-ups in the film are portrayed as being entirely out of control. So we wonder, what do the youngsters have to look forward to? Parents cannot prevent their children from smoking, drinking, cutting themselves, using drugs, or running away. In fact, one of the girls brags about how she keeps a tight hand on her mother. Teachers cannot stop students from cutting or fleeing the classroom, beating each other, or adhering to punishments. Neither do they manage, despite checking backpacks and handbags, to prevent alcohol from entering school property. Clearly, the inmates are running for asylum. To turn to stylistic issues, which I think are actually very, very interesting in this film, though it's not entirely clear how to speak about them. What's most remarkable about the film, from the moment that it starts, is its constant, incessant camera movement, perhaps done by steady cam, sometimes the film perhaps handheld, I'm not sure, which continually moves in front, in back, or alongside the characters as they progress through space. Furthermore, it lends a tremendous dynamism to the movie, which seems to match the frenetic, youthful energy of the girls who navigate a chaotic world, attempting to gain a foothold. They never seem to gain a foothold, and to some degree with the camera movement, I would wait. When the camera is not peripatetic in this fashion, it is often swish panic between characters in a scene, shifting from one individual to another. The camera has a decidedly bodily feel to it, as though it were another individual in the group. And of course, this is logical, since it is the unseen camera versus the body that operates it. This and the close-up cinematography, and that's very important in this film. A lot of it is extreme close-up combined with moving camera. This and the close-up cinematography sutures the spectator into this drama as though he or she is a participant. Just as the teenage girls have no escape from the tumultuous circumstances in which they